this is where Texas politics gets interesting. Here again are two guys named Jason, some great guests, and cold Texas beer for another smart conversation on Y'allitics, the unofficial political podcast of Texas.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another week of Y'allitics, and yet another week when Jason Whiteley is, you know, not at work. Who knows where he is, but he's not here. But that's okay, because, you know, he deserves to travel out of town and not have to, you know, be on the podcast, even though our guest today is also traveling out of town, but made the time to be here on the podcast with us. It's been a while since we've checked in with Doug Lewin, the president of Stoic Energy here in Texas, as well as the host of the Energy Capital podcast. And it is always a smart conversation that reveals so much about something that all of us need to care about. And of course, that is electricity here in Texas. Doug, you are joining us today from St. Louis.
That's right. That's right. And I've got a St. Louis beer for the occasion too.
I love it. Show me what you brought. What'd you bring to the podcast?
So yeah, St. Louis is my hometown and big Cardinals fan and all that good stuff. And there's quite a few good breweries, not as many as in Texas. I still am partial to Texas beer. Don't worry. But this is a good one. Four Hands Brewing is a really good brewery in St. Louis. And this is their statewide hazy. I actually like their citywide American Pale even better, but this is the one I had today. And it's a good one.
Nice. Feel free to crack that thing open too. Is that a larger than usual can, or is it just the camera?
You know, we're talking about the Texas grid, right? I mean, you need a 16 ounce pour, not 12, right, Jason?
You know, I came unprepared in that case because I've just got a 12 ouncer today, and I picked out one of my favorites, which is Austin East Ciders, their blood orange cider.
Good one,
really, yeah. Light, really crisp, really refreshing. And the reason I picked that, Doug, is because, you know, I'm still stuck down here in Texas. You're probably, I mean, Missouri gets hot. You guys are dealing with summer up there as well. But it is just blistering here, typical August day. And, you know, that's why we're getting into these numbers with electricity demand that are just extraordinary.
Yes, yes, it is. It is a little bit hot up here, not as bad as down there, but I'll be heading back to share in the misery soon. And yeah, it's like we're pushing last year's all-time record at ERCOT, but not quite there with this heat, but close.
So 80-something thousand gigawatts, I think, that is where we – I think yesterday we were at 80 – as we record this, we're recording this on Thursday. Yesterday, on Wednesday, we recorded 83.6 gigawatts, I think it was, of demand. That is extraordinary. And if you can just kind of put that into perspective, Doug, historically speaking, these are big numbers.
Very big. I mean, the most we had coming into the summer of, I think it was 2022, we first hit 80. Last year, we hit 85. So really before 2022, we hadn't gotten above like 75 gigawatts. And now it's pretty routine. If it's, you know, high 90s in Dallas, Houston, and Austin, San Antonio, we're going to hit 80 pretty much all the time. But yeah, coming into August 2023, we had never gotten, you know, to the 83.6 we hit yesterday. So it is historically a quite high level.
Okay, so we had that enormous demand on the system, and yet we had quite a bit left over to go around in case it was needed. You know, I think that we've all gotten accustomed now, Doug. It's almost like, you know, second nature where we have these hot spells here in Texas, and or even some, you know, spells when it's not so hot or even fairly cool outside, where it seems like we're asked day after day, hey, we need you to cut back. We have, you know, a potential situation here. We get these, you know, updates from the Electric Reliability Council of Texas, or ERCOT, telling us, hey, you know, this is, you know, kind of critical here. We just need everybody to kind of pitch in. We haven't been seeing a lot of that. And I monitor your X feed, formerly known as Twitter, a lot. And I've seen, you know, the things that you've been saying about batteries. It seems like batteries have really been saving our skin in a lot of cases.
Well, really, it's the combination of solar and storage that are really making the big difference there, Jason. Is, you know, it used to be, I was talking with somebody about this just the other day. I remember the summer of 2019, it got really hot. And I remember talking to people about, you know, there were some conservation alerts that summer, and are we going to end up with rolling outages? And everybody was worried about 3, 4, or 5 in the afternoon. Like, that was the time that was really kind of like you were sweating literally and figuratively. And now, you know, 3, 4, 5 in the afternoon, we saw yesterday there was a buffer of like 11,000 megawatts, you know, so again, peak hitting like 83, we had around 95,000 available. Most of that is solar. It is around the country. It's very hard to build new gas plants. It's hard to get the investment for it. Investors aren't really excited about putting money into fossil fuel infrastructure. It's not just a Texas problem. It's everywhere. But most places are not able to attract even a small fraction of the amount of solar and storage we're getting in Texas. And that's a really positive story. So yesterday, when we hit that 83,000 megawatts, 20,000 of that was coming from solar. That's phenomenal. And that's, you know, last summer, to put that in perspective, when we hit that 85,000 megawatts, we were getting about 13,000. So 50% more just year over year. It's an extraordinary growth and an extraordinary success story for Texas.
Doug, I'd like to get down into that a little bit. I think that a few minutes ago I may have said 83,000 gigawatts. That truly would have been a record. It was 83,000 megawatts, so don't send me the hate mail, anybody. I think that's fascinating and deserves to have a line drawn under it there, that on these enormous demand days, we're seeing as much as, you know, 20% of this coming from solar.
That's right. More. I mean, on some days, even on hot days, we're getting as high as 25%. And that's, again, that is not by any means a ceiling. We're going to continue to see that grow, barring any, you know, goofy, counterproductive, you know, policy changes or something like that. We're going to continue to see that grow. And that's going to make the prospect of outages or even conservation alerts on these super hot days, even with rising demand, even with, you know, EVs needing to charge, and even with data centers coming to the state, with all that new solar, we likely will not have problems at 3, 4, 5 in the afternoon, again, barring any major change.
So solar, it has just been going in here at an incredible rate then. I mean, is this yes, more than what we've been seeing in recent years? Have we seen an acceleration of these, you know, solar farms going up?
Yeah, I mean, it's nearly an exponential kind of a growth, like really a hockey stick kind of a growth. And again, we're seeing this around the world. We're seeing just huge deployment of solar, because we got a couple years ago, depending, you know, it all depends on where you are and how much sun you actually have. Obviously, Texas is a very sunny place. It depends on other sort of local factors. But by and large, we've now seen solar become cheaper than other sources, not even just building them new, but even of operating the ones that are on the system. So we've really seen this huge reduction in cost for solar over time. And that has then, of course, led to an increase in deployment. So yes, we've seen, I mean, we were, you know, 5 years ago, we had a couple thousand megawatts. Now we're up to 26,000 megawatts installed, hitting routinely now 20,000 megawatts of actual production. Because you never get 100%, no matter what the source is, you never get 100% output. Right. But with solar, you're getting, you know, 80-something percent. Yeah.
So wait, Doug, where do we rank, you know, with the other states as far as solar and wind and battery at this point?
Number one in wind, have been number one for a long time. So we were just talking about, you know, 26,000 installed of solar. We're just shy of about 40,000 of wind. And that's just in ERCOT. There's some wind outside of ERCOT too. So we're actually more than 40,000 statewide. Sometimes I have to catch myself and go, that's right. ERCOT is not, you know, there is a portion of the panhandle, for instance, that is outside of ERCOT. It's very, very windy. So there's a lot of wind up there too. Mm-hmm. So we're number one in wind, number one in utility scale solar. So the really large stuff, right? Think of large fields of solar panels. We're number one in that. We passed California sometime probably last year. It depends on whose numbers you use, but we're past them. Mm-hmm. And in on output as well, they've never hit 20,000, at least up until the last time I looked a couple of days ago, they'd never reached 20. And we're now routinely over 20 on batteries. Well, and let me just say this too, Jason, we lag California and a lot of other states on distributed solar, solar rooftop, which is a big, big deal, especially when you look at what happened. I know we're going to talk about Hurricane Beryl. Mm-hmm. Having that local production closer to where the power is used is a big It's a resiliency strategy, reliability strategy, an affordability strategy. It does all those things, and we lag severely there, and we could talk about that. Batteries were now number two. California is still ahead of us, but I suspect some point next year we will probably pass California. We have more growth in ERCOT, so that's leading more developers to look to site storage here.
Batteries have become such a big deal, and I read more and more about this, it seems, every day. Let's talk about timing of day with batteries, because, you know, basically, you know, when that sun is shining and the wind is blowing, you know, let's say all the plants are, you know, the gas plants, the coal plants are operating full tilt, they're doing great, sending out enough power, we have more than enough. You're able to just dump some of this power that you're pulling from the sun and from the wind down into these batteries, so that later on, you know, if the sun and the wind start to fade, you can still power those batteries up, and it's like, you know, you didn't miss a beat there. How critical is that? And because we're talking about those hours a lot of times when a lot of us are home, we're turning on the oven, we're turning on the AC all the way down because we've been hot all day. We got the TVs going, we got the washing machine going maybe. Those are critical hours.
Yeah, absolutely. And so when I was talking about, you know, 3, 4, 5 o'clock isn't the time people worry about, if you're in the ERCOT control room or you're a policymaker or you're somebody like me that watches the grid all the time, you know, what you're really looking at now is that kind of 7, 8, 9 o'clock hour, even pushing close to 10 o'clock on some days, because you do have a drop in demand in the evening hours. We're not using as much at 7 or 8 o'clock as we were at 3 or 4 or 5. 5 is really kind of 5 o'clock is the hour ending at 5 o'clock is usually the peak, sometimes 6. So it's definitely coming down, but it's not a precipitous drop off, right? Demand is still high. Like you said, people are doing things in their homes in the evening. They want that air conditioner to continue to run. So there tends to be an hour or two kind of gap there. And we do have this kind of diurnal pattern, not only of the sun, but of wind too, where you get much less wind output in the middle of the day and more in the evening. Some days that wind ramps up really fast. Some days it's kind of slower. And having that storage there to fill in that hour or two is really, really critical. And what we're seeing, Jason, is, and you can see this, ERCOT's done a good job. You know, we bash ERCOT all the time. Good to give them some praise when they're doing things right. Their dashboard is actually really useful, and I encourage people to get on there and look at it. You can see every day when storage is charging and discharging. And what happens is, they discharge at night. They just stay, you know, they'll have some charging going on overnight. But you see at 8 a.m. just as the sun's coming up, that discharge, the line below zero on the graph goes way down. Today it was like almost 2,000 megawatts of charging as soon as the sun comes up. So you can see it very graphically right there in front of you, is we're charging those batteries when we got plenty of solar power, and we're discharging them as the sun goes down. So we've got 8,000 megawatts of storage. At the time of Winter Storm Uri, we just, you know, not even 4 years ago, we had like 200.
Wow.
So 200 to 8,000 in less than 4 years. And we are not, and that's not showing signs of abating. We are probably going to maybe not double, but add 70, 80% before next summer. We'll probably be somewhere around 15. Yeah, it's incredible. It's a great, great story for Texas, really good for reliability, for affordability, for sustainability, really whatever sort of thing you want to look at, batteries are really good for it.
I want to say this too. We've talked before about, you know, how Texas has this aging fleet of, you know, traditional power plants, the gas, the coal, et cetera. They really struggle. A lot of these are much older plants. They are workhorses for sure. They have been, you know, steady over the years, but they break down. They have trouble in this heat just like the rest of us. And I saw you put out a message the other day that, you know, talked about this big coal plant that went offline during those critical evening hours that you were just talking about. And I liked what you said here. You said with batteries filling in, though, the market shrugged. You know, there was no conservation call, no emergency. You didn't see prices on the wholesale market for electricity spiking like crazy. And it was because those batteries just kicked on and did what they do.
I mean, how great is that, right? Like, who wouldn't want this? I don't understand. I think most people are excited about batteries. And anybody that isn't, it's unless you have a competitive interest against it, I can't understand why anybody wouldn't be pretty excited about this. Again, yeah, you're exactly right. The coal plant is over 600 megawatts. And it dropped off at about 6 p.m. And we never saw prices get even to 5% of what the max price in the market is, $5,000 a megawatt hour. I believe that night we didn't even exceed like 250. It might have actually spiked above that for like 5 minutes or something. But basically, it just wasn't a problem at all. Not only did we not have conservation calls, we didn't have high prices. So yeah, storage is really playing that key role of filling in. Now, I do think it's important that we get to the point where we also have demand response in the market, that we have demand response is that term of art that basically is just a fancy way of saying people can get paid to participate in programs that would, just like they're going to store up a battery when the sun is up, your home, if it's well insulated, that's thermal storage. Your home is a battery. You can pre-cool it, make it 70 degrees on a hot summer day. Who wouldn't like to be 70 inside their home on a hot summer day? And then just use less in those evening hours, but your set point never gets above 73, 74, 75, whatever you decide you want it to be, and you're paid for that. That's another resource that if, you know, because this was just one power plant, but when we start, you know, we start to get to temperatures, Jason, that are 105, 110, you could easily see multiple power plants go offline because that heat not only is tough on us, right? It's tough on the machinery as well, right? And so those older plants start to break down. And if you get multiple plants breaking at the same time, storage is great. You want to have another line of defense, and demand flexibility can provide that.
So Doug, let's say that you and I and, you know, everybody else decides like, hey, yeah, I want part of that program. If they'll pay me for that, or if it'll, you know, be a bill credit, you know, if I participate in this, I want in on that. If a lot of people did that, Does the state benefit more than it would pay out?
Well, the state wouldn't be paying out.
These are competitive market.
Yeah. This should be, if it's done right, they should be competitive market functions. And so particularly, it depends where you live, right? But for obviously for Dallas, Fort Worth, for Houston, you have competition. Whoever your retail electric provider is, ask them. They might have a program already where they'll pay you to sign up. Now, you may not like the way they've set up that program, and you want to ask good questions, right? Mm-hmm. Make sure you know what you're signing up for. But a well-crafted program, to me, is going to involve some amount of pre-cooling of the home so that you're not, nobody wants their house going above 80 degrees on a hot day. I'm not signing up for that program. Probably right. Nobody is. And so to answer your question, though, it's highly economic. It actually makes the market a more well-functioning market because you have another resource in there that's competing against other resources. And the beautiful thing about that for us as Texans is we have a chance then to be paid for that. Unlike the other resources, even batteries, as great as they are, you're not getting paid when the batteries get paid. You can get paid for participating in demand response.
And the idea there is that I, as a rate payer, I'm saving some money because they're, you know, economically or financially incentivizing that for me. But my power company saves some money as well, because if we don't get into a huge crunch because we're all using too much at the same time, they don't have to go out onto a wholesale market where the prices have gone through the roof and just eat it and buy that, you know, electricity at ridiculous prices. That's the idea.
Exactly correct. And if they have enough generation, even though they have a bunch of customers participating, they can then sell that generation back into the market. So yes, there's a win-win there for the retail electric provider and for the customer.
So I want to ask you this, because, you know, batteries, you know, seem like they're really doing so much, wind and solar doing so much, but yet I remember the last legislative session that we went through here in Texas a couple of years ago, and I'm sure you remember it way better than I do. You know, renewables were under a lot of threats. There were a lot of bills proposed that were very, very unfriendly to your part of the industry there. What are you anticipating as we go into this next legislative session? Do you think that you guys are going to be facing that kind of hostile environment again, or do you think that, you know, these resources have proven themselves in such a way and saved the state really from having to make these, you know, big emergency calls over and over again enough times, and, you know, they see that the growth here in demand, you know, is that going to save you guys, or are you anticipating another rocky legislative session?
I mean, I would like to think that the legislature is going to move beyond the attacks on renewables, but I don't think that will be the case. I think it's more likely that we will see attacks on renewables again. It really is, you know, the legislature cutting off its nose to spite its face. Like, this is the way, if you want economic growth, you want new manufacturing in the state, you know, you want people to be able to move here and for this state to grow, you're really fighting gravity and swimming upstream to try to do all that with new fossil plants. It's basically impossible. I mean, the state just put $5 billion towards new fossil plants. We'll see how well they put $3.6 billion. $900 million of that is going to microgrids, and we should talk about that. But the bulk of that $5 billion is going to new gas plants, and we'll see how many they actually get for that. But it's not, I don't think it'll probably even equal a year of solar and storage with no state dollars going towards it. So, and it's not to say that, you know, they can do what they, you know, they want to put something towards gas or whatever, fine. But to, that's like a proactive kind of a policy to do something to actually reduce the amount of energy resources coming onto the grid would be crazy. Would really just be, you know, self-defeating. I don't know how else to put it. So I hope they move beyond it, but I suspect we'll see some of the proposals again that surfaced during the last session, the ones that require all sorts of permitting stuff that doesn't apply to, for instance, oil and gas drilling, but would apply to solar, as if solar, you know, production was more harmful than oil and gas drilling. It's really, I don't know how else to describe it as self-defeating. And I hope that the legislature, you know, doesn't cross over that line, which they almost did last session. It really would have hurt the state.
But the renewables industry, fair to say, is gearing up for that.
Sure. I mean, it has to, because they're the last, you know, I mean, however many sessions you can count, these kinds of proposals have been there, and they haven't just been filed. I mean, Senate Bill 624 actually passed the Senate. Some of the, you know, proposals made it into House Bill 1500 that would add cost to renewables. And whenever you hear that, somebody says, we need to add cost to renewables, watch your wallet. They're adding cost to your energy bill. That's what's happening. Because anytime you add cost to a resource, that's flowing through to you. They're going to add that in, you know, the developers add that into their costs, and ratepayers end up paying it.
Okay, so you guys are going to be down at the Capitol, I imagine, a lot of days starting in January. How much, though, before we even get to that point, are you concerned about national elections in November, you know, presidential, for the U.S. House, for the U.S. Senate? How closely are you keeping tabs on that with regard to your industry?
Well, obviously, it all matters in a major way, of course. You know, the Biden administration, and we just passed the 2-year anniversary of the Inflation Reduction Act. The Inflation Reduction Act has had a massive impact on the energy industry in a lot of ways, too many ways to get into in the time we have. But the one that I would really highlight is those tax credits that have been there for solar and wind and now expanded for batteries. Actually, it's now easier for batteries to get those tax credits. There's also tax credits for the fossil fuel industry for carbon capture and for hydrogen and things like that. But all of these tax credits have domestic content requirements. So we are seeing more and more manufacturing locating in the United States, battery manufacturing, solar panel manufacturing, wind manufacturing, so on and so forth. This has been, when you look at the charts of manufacturing activity in the United States, it's been a huge leap over the last year as the IRA has worked its way through the system. Actually, just this week, as we're recording, there was a letter sent to Speaker Johnson from 18 House Republicans. I don't believe anywhere from Texas. I actually need to go back and look at that list and make sure that's true. But 18 House Republicans sent a note to Speaker Johnson saying, if Trump wins, we do not want to repeal at least portions of the IRA. And that's because a lot of that economic activity is happening in Republican districts. And in fact, the vast majority of that economic activity is happening in Republican districts. So it's a really interesting dynamic. I wouldn't make any predictions as to what would happen in a second Trump term or in a Harris administration, but I think it's safe to say the Harris administration would generally continue Biden policies that are supportive of clean energy, and President Trump would probably try to reverse some of those things, but I think he would have tailwinds within his own party from members of Congress and from governors, like Governor Kemp of Georgia. Georgia's been one of the biggest beneficiaries of all the manufacturing, and Trump's been feuding with him lately. He would have a lot of tailwinds within his own party to try to get rid of some of those policies.
You know, it's interesting that you mention the IRA money that's been flowing for manufacturing and that going to a lot of traditionally red places politically. You know, fair to point out that, you know, much of the wind and solar in this state comes from areas and is creating jobs and some passive income out there as well in very red areas, too.
Yes. Passive income, another way to put it, is mailbox money, right? And there are stories all across the state. I saw one the other day of former House member John Davis, a Republican House member who chaired, I think he chaired the Health Committee in the House under Speaker Craddock. You know, he would have lost his ranch were it not for a wind lease he got on his ranch. And you hear this story just over and over and over in this state. It's very hard for the small farmers and ranchers to keep their land. And if they can do that, and as Davis did, I think it was, he's the fourth or fifth generation, and now he's able to keep it in his family for another generation. That's obviously a very big deal. And again, anti-renewable policies, like it's anti-Texas. It just, it hurts our state.
Just as someone who's been suffering in the stock market lately, Doug, I can't tell you how much I wish I just had some dusty piece of land way out there that had wind rights and some of that mailbox money coming in. Before we let you go today, we have to get into this whole, you know, Hurricane Beryl situation. Center Point, which is the, you know, the transmission and distribution utility in the Houston area. Man, have they been on the hot seat after a very sluggish response after that storm and so many people without power. I'm happy to report that before he left, Jason Whiteley did do a little bit of work and spoke with Senator Paul Bettencourt from down in the Houston area. He is one of the lawmakers really holding CenterPoint's feet to the fire right now. Let's listen in real quick on a couple of the things that he had to say.
Senator, good to see you again. I want to ask you about those 20 large generators. Let's start right there that CenterPoint Energy had. Customers, including you, paid for those over the last few years. CenterPoint didn't even roll them out and use them during Hurricane Beryl. And you heard the CEO say why he did not. But you discussed the possibility of legislation to maybe get some of that money back that CenterPoint customers paid for that. What would that look like if it were to happen?
Well, first off, that's about $800 million of a capital purchase. And what people need to understand is that public utilities in the state, they get a profit margin on top of that. So there was a big discussion in the hearing about how much that is. It was at least $30 million, et cetera. So not only did we buy 15 boat anchors that are big, giant 32 megawatt generators, they also made a profit margin on it. And you're absolutely right. They haven't turned them on once since they bought them because they're too big. And part of the problem is if you buy too big, it takes 5 days to move them and set them up. So it's a really wasted purchase. But even worse than that, they leased them. So the cost was probably more like $1.2 billion. And even worse than that, they didn't go with the low bidder. CenterPoint, what I would hope, would willingly discuss the need to return that money back to the ratepayers. That's what I hope happens, because all you can do is point out stupidity and triplicate like this was and say, hey, we should have never have done this. We can't use these things. They're boat anchors around the ratepayers. And so cough up some of the money. If I was an inspector general, that contract is so weird and so suspicious with such a small company. It had all sorts of terms in it that favored an operating lease versus a straight buy. I mean, I would be investigating it for fraud.
You live in and obviously represent the Houston area. Do you trust CenterPoint?
At this point, they've got a lot to make up. I'll quote Senator Kolkhorst from the hearing. She's from Brennan. The trust with the consumers is broken.
Let's zoom out for a moment here. We're still in hurricane season. We saw the committee hearing that happened a few days ago. What do you expect concrete legislatively to come out of that committee hearing?
Well, what I expect concrete is coming out of that hearing is we're going to have a serious discussion about clawing back this $800 million, especially after the letter the Lieutenant Governor is going to release to the PUC. We're going to look at how the PUC made the decision to approve those generators in the first place and look and make sure that there is enough, safeguards there to keep a major decision like that happening again, because they overrode a administrative law judge who said, don't do this. And they went ahead and overrode them. Then we're going to look at top-down guidelines and legislation about mandating these composite poles, looking at, you know, vegetation removal, et cetera, what we could do to follow that Florida model that worked. But in the meantime, I'm expecting, you know, Reliant to get with it, CenterPoint to get with it. By the way, Reliant was fine. We had plenty of energy.
Right.
We just couldn't get it to the folks.
Okay? On the power lines, yeah.
Yeah, the power lines. But they're supposed to release a tracker today, which was another just blow your head off stupidity that they had the ability for people to look up and say, hey, is my power coming on or not? And they turned it off after our first storm. And, you know, I mean, that was, subject to one of my Aggieisms, which is double blank. I won't say what it is, but it's stupid. Okay. So they've got a lot of stupidity to come out of the, out of the grave on here before they get the public's trust back.
Senator, we'll be watching as well, too. Thanks so much for the insight. Always good to talk to you.
Thank you.
All right. So Doug, after, hearing what Senator Betancourt has to say here, and this is something that we've been hearing in a bipartisan fashion, lawmakers not happy, first of all, with the response to Beryl by CenterPoint. Before we get into the lawmakers' end of it, what is your reaction to what happened there in the Houston area after a Category 1 hurricane and just how crippled the infrastructure was after that and how long it took to bring it back? What does it say about our grid?
Yeah, I mean, I have so many thoughts, Jason, as you might imagine. First of all, I think it's really important to say, to give a little bit of grace here, that Category 1 is still a very powerful storm, and Houston right. took the dirty side. So I think it's important to not minimize this was a really powerful storm. That having been said, there's no excuse for the response. There's no excuse for the terrible communications. There's no excuse for the lack of investment and replacing poles and doing tree trimming and all of those things that should have happened. I'll just say two other things on this. Number one, a lot of times I hear when these kinds of things happen, oh, that's not the grid. And what people mean when they say that is they mean, oh, that's not ERCOT. That's not the transmission level grid. Right. The grid is the whole thing. The grid is what goes to your home. And in fact, with increasing technology, with advancing technology, with solar and storage and demand response and all this, your home is increasingly becoming part of the grid. And yes, the distribution grid is part of the grid, and we need to think about it from the power plants all the way down to the end user. And Texas has struggled with reliability and affordability for a long, long time. We are in the bottom third on almost every metric when you look at nationwide scorecards. Even blue sky days where there's not an extreme weather event, we're in the bottom third. We're in the bottom third for duration of outages, for frequency of outages, and it's not just CenterPoint. This is across the state. So I think that is a very important thing to highlight here. And the other thing that I really just, I can't emphasize this enough. We were talking earlier about the state putting $5 billion towards gas plants. Actually, $900 million of that was to go to microgrids or backup power at critical facilities. Had those dollars been deployed before Beryl, the fire departments that had to shut down and relocate firemen would have been able to remain up. The water treatment plants that were scrambling to get diesel generators would have already had generation on site. Assisted living centers where people died would have had power. The PUC and the legislature need to prioritize that $900 million, begin to put out an application process and receive applications to spend that money, because it helps in these kinds of situations. It also, you know, when we're talking about these hot days and, you know, when the sun goes down, things are tight on the grid. If you have a solar and storage and even gas microgrid, like HEBs have these gas microgrids. Mm-hmm. I just did a podcast with Enchanted Rock. the company that provides those microgrids. You then are able to use that power year long to help with your resource adequacy, to make sure you have enough power. It helps with affordability, lowers customers' bills. And when the inevitable next hurricane comes through, you've got power at these critical facilities. Mm-hmm. So I'm excited the legislature passed that policy. We talked about some of the short-sighted policies that I hope they stay away from next session and instead focus on helping Texans get solar and storage and gas microgrids closest to where the power is used that increases reliability and resiliency.
Yeah, it's great to approve the money. You got to spend it too and get it done. Speaking of generators, CenterPoint has been taking a lot of heat for these enormous generators that the company bought. They were supposed to help in extended power outages like we saw with the February 2021 winter storm. Those sat idle during this post-barrel power outage. And boy, are lawmakers hot under the collar about that one. They don't want to see that passed on to consumers, and they're not happy about it. Your thoughts on that?
Again, so many thoughts. I think the most important thing here is we have to ask, what is a transmission and distribution utility supposed to do? What is their mission? What is their purpose? Their purpose is to maintain the transmission distribution grid. Their purpose is not to generate electricity. There's a different segment of the market that does that. They mm-hmm. need to focus on their job. And this is where, and I think that this is just so important. I'm glad that the public is starting to understand this. Policymakers are talking about it. Senator Betancourt mentioned it on the interview with the other Jason, with the less great Jason, of course.
The absent Jason, we'll call him today.
The absent Jason. He talked about this, that, you know, the way the utility business model works right now, and this is when I'm talking about utilities, these are fully regulated monopolies, right? We have competitive generation in Texas. We have competitive retail. But this part, there's no competition there. They are monopolies, literally no competition, and they make a profit on every dollar they spend. So they testified to the Senate that they made $30 million off these generators that could not be used. Hmm. A, they need to give that back. And second, really first, I mean, the primary thing is here, we need to change that utility business model and give them performance metrics and say, recovery time after a hurricane, number of people affected by outages, length of outages, right? All these are the metrics that matter. Pay them based on that. And if you did that, if you said, hey, if you get those outage times way down, we'll give you the 10% rate of return that you're asking for in your rate case, I guarantee you they wouldn't buy more generators. Yeah. They would do more tree trimming, right? They would do the blocking and tackling, the basic stuff that would keep the grid up, because their financial incentives would be aligned with the policy goals the policymakers have for them. So this is going to be critical. I hope that the legislature, again, will not focus on, you know, sort of useless distractions like trying to somehow harm renewable energy, and instead put a focus on these kinds of things that could be long-term structural change that will yield real reliability benefits for Texans.
Yeah, it might not inspire a lot of confidence, though, Doug, when you think about the fact that, you know, we've had elected leaders all the way to the top here in Texas coming out after this post-barrel disaster. And boy, they're taking shots at CenterPoint. It's an easy target right now because, you know, customers, a lot of them feel the same way. But you think about it, and there's so much shock and outrage from a lot of these lawmakers. But the system, you know, the system wasn't created by CenterPoint. CenterPoint is playing in the game where the rules were set up by, you know, lawmakers and elected leaders in this state. They oversaw this. They created this.
Yes, and they passed the bill that allowed them to buy these large generators. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there was another article in the Houston Chronicle this week about this, that, you know, some of the legislators at the hearing, Senator King, Senator Alvarado, some of the others that were saying, this is terrible. How could you buy the large generators? That's not what was intended. They had put letters in the record at the PUC saying, let them do the large generators. I'm paraphrasing, but the number 500 megawatts was in Senator King's letter. How could you assume that they were going to buy enough small generators to equal 500 megawatts? You'd have to buy thousands of them. Mm-hmm. So or hundreds, I should say, not thousands. Yeah. You'd have to buy hundreds of them to reach that level. So you're absolutely right. The legislature created this framework, and I think it is very easy to beat up on CenterPoint, particularly right now. But I really hope that the legislators do some introspection, something, politicians maybe don't do enough of. Yeah, so I just mentioned Senator King, and I think it's important to say he did apologize to his colleagues on that committee and said that, you can go back and, put a clip or something or link to that in there. I won't try to quote him, but he did apologize. And I think the key right now was for the legislature to recognize their role in this and to use the power they have to change that business model to a pay for performance. The whole regulatory structure for a monopoly utility is meant to simulate competition because they have no competition, right? So you need to compete. You need a benchmark to other utilities. What are the best in class utilities? And if you reach that level, you get your 10% profits. If you don't, you get 7 or 8%, right? And so really creating that metric that is just, it's very common sense. Pay for performance. Don't pay on how much they spend. So to me, more than any sort of, beating up on CenterPoint or apologies or anything like that, what's going to matter is the action. Does the legislature actually change the system? Action speaks louder than words. So we'll watch and see what they do this session.
Yes, always watch what they do, not what they say. My last thing for you, Doug, is sort of a full circle here. I want to close with a question about batteries and relate that to Hurricane Beryl. What are the potentials down the road that we, ahead of time, like there's battery storage, let's say, in that, immediate vicinity around these places that are prone to these huge storms like Houston. What is the potential to have batteries in place there? And when you've got a storm that's out in the Gulf, you're able to just start dumping power down into those batteries with the anticipation that a lot of people are going to be without electricity after it's over with. I mean, I know it wasn't necessarily an issue with, having electricity coming in. It was more the lines in this case, but would that help?
It would help in a major way. Absolutely. And again, if you look at the policy that the legislature passed, it was in Senate Bill 2627. We all voted on it. Well, 10% of Texans voted on it in Proposition 7 and the constitutional amendment. It passed 65% or something like that. And that was to put money towards microgrids at critical facilities. And the law requires that that be a mix of solar, storage, and gas. So you have redundancy, right? And if those are in place, absolutely, you would then have hospitals, assisted living centers, nursing homes, police and fire stations, cooling centers, right? Municipal buildings that can be used as what are often called resilience hubs, schools, right? Some place, there's an elementary school within a certain distance of almost everybody in a major metro area, right? You can get there. That's a place you can go. We start to this. We've got to start thinking about these things because you're right. While I said a Category 1 isn't a small hurricane, it's a major hurricane. It is. It's not hard to imagine. I wouldn't want to spend too long doing this, but had that one been a Category 4 or 5, we aren't ready yet for the changes that are coming. These storms are intensifying. Climate change is real. We aren't seeing more hurricanes. That is not in the data. We are seeing more intense, right, hurricanes. And so we've got to be ready for this. And yes, having storage on site, you don't even have to move it around, right? You got the solar, the storage, the gas generator there at the critical facility. When the critical facility is just wave one, we can start talking about neighborhood microgrids. Your home can literally be a microgrid. It's a fancy word, but it basically just means when the grid goes down, you can continue to produce power. And we can even set up a system where you share that power with your neighbors. What's more Texan and neighborly than that, right? And that's all possible, but you got to have a utility that's motivated to make that happen. You got to have policymakers that are working towards that goal. We're not quite there yet, but absolutely that is possible.
And you know, there's, in addition to money savings, you think about the potential savings in lives when you start
Absolutely.
Talking about the sweltering temperatures after a storm rolls through and people don't have power, or those extraordinarily cold temperatures like we saw in February of 2021 after Winter Storm Uri, and so many people lost their lives. Doug Lewin, you always make us smarter on here, president of Stoic Energy, host of his own podcast called the Energy Capital Podcast. Thanks for making us smarter once again. You know, Whiteley really does need to be here when you're here, because he could stand to be a little smarter.
No comment, Jason.
No, maybe he is the smarter one. He's always off. I'm always working. I guess I have to give him that.
You drew the short straw today. Thank you, Jason.
It seems like
thanks
I do a lot. Doug, thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Okay, y'all. The conversation doesn't stop here. Find us on Twitter and Instagram. We're at Yolitics.